This budget division will come to order. Before we start our meeting today, and I know we don't have all our members in here, but there's never really a good time because we all are running behind this time of the year. But I wanted to announce that that one of the proposals that was in the governor's budget that we didn't hear a lot of opposition to, at least in our public testimony, has to be delayed because of the latest interpretation of the maintenance of effort requirements because of the federal FMAP, enhanced revenues. And it is the nursing home level of care provisions. They related both to nursing home and to community-based long-term care. And the loss of that revenue from the governor's budget is about $30.9 million for this biennium, and the tails were significantly higher than that. And so while the governor had some money on the bottom line and doesn't need to replace all of this $30.9 million, we do. And so it is a development that is complicating things somewhat in terms of our budgeting process. The second thing is that in the course of getting some of the pages in the governor's budget repriced based on other assumptions, we discovered that the governor's pages were not priced correctly. And that left them with a hole, not as large as ours, but nevertheless, it left them with not having a balanced budget in front of us. And so they are now working on trying to propose new things to make their budget complete. And we have not received any information at this point in time about what those things will be. And so that's just all my long way of saying that this is really kind of a mess. And so we may not be ready by next week on the 16th to adopt a spreadsheet, but we are continuing to work toward that, and I hope that we won't be behind by too many days. All right. With that, let's start. And we have Senator Vickerman, Senate File 648. And Senator Vickerman has a witness from out of town. And we do have a long agenda today, so we are going to ask people to be to the point, and we'll do the best to get through all the bills we have today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me be first. I'm trying to chair a Veterans Committee at the same time, and that's what's happening here when we get close to D-Day. So this is Senate File 648. It's a home for created living relocation. Madam Chair, essence of time, I'm going to ask Ms. Nelson, CEO, to explain the bill and what we want to do, and then we both can be moving along a little faster. I have Mr. Olson here, too, just as a kind of a backup individual. So, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Before we begin, I just want to call attention to the members that we have an A1 delete everything amendment. We aren't. Don't quite have a quorum yet to adopt the amendment, Senator Vickerman, but I just want to make everyone aware that that's what you'll be working off of.
Madam Chair, I was informed that the Senate Council would have that amendment here. I am not on this committee, so I can't offer it.
We'll have someone offer it for you when we get a quorum.
Okay. You got the amendment?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer that.
Senator Rosen offers the amendment, and we'll just have it before us then. Senator Vickerman, do you want to have Mr. Nelson proceed first here?
Madam Chair, I think that would be faster because he knows
that
this a lot
fine.
More than I do.
Great. Welcome to our committee.
Great. Thank you. I'll just briefly talk about a little history of why we're here and why Senate File 648 seeking the relocation, funding for the relocation of the Home for Creative Living, we believe, is necessary. HCL was opened in September of 1977, licensed as a Class B ICFMR home serving 45 children with multiple physical and intellectual disabilities. over the years. Currently, the home serves 21 adults from 13 different counties in southwest and south central Minnesota. The home was downsized in 1994 from 45 children to 21 adults and children, which is how it is currently licensed. Over time, the building has become increasingly inadequate for use as a residence. Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry Code will require that the elevator be replaced by January 2012 at considerable expense, which doesn't make a lot of sense for a building that in many other ways has outlived its usefulness as a home for people with developmental disabilities. We purchased a stair climber in last year to facilitate evacuation drills because some other changes in code that require us to, the building is designed for lateral egress in the event of a fire and then evacuation with outside help. But for drill purposes, we had to purchase a stair climber and put on additional staff to facilitate that. We introduced this legislation last year during the OH session, and understandably it was not a great time, nor I guess is this year, to bring legislation forward seeking funding. But there are some reasons we feel that it has merit. Cottonwood County, we met with Cottonwood County, and obviously they are supporting our plan to relocate, and they're looking at having one or two. Our bill would allow us to close the 21-bed facility, which is actually in the former Wyndham Hospital, and construct three fully accessible homes that would each be home to six people. There'd be a 3-and-3 townhome design. The design, six people, would give us some economy of scale and also allow us to share staff at certain times of the day to, again, further keep costs somewhat in line. But the homes would be located in Wyndham and also in areas in southwest South Central Minnesota at working with the people that live there, their families and guardians, as far as where they would be located. We've talked to two or three counties in the area that have expressed interest should funding become available. The need for this type of housing, we believe, will endure along, you know, the future of ICFMR as a funding and model is always something that's been debated. I think it will endure for a while, but should something happen, there is a real shortage of quality housing in that part of the state that is fully accessible, not only physical accessibility, but also for medical equipment and devices that people living there should need. Obviously, the advantages, as your committee well knows, to getting this done as an ICFMR versus another type of housing such as waiver is that in the ICFMR model, the federal match is applied to the building and property costs as well as the program, unlike other options that would be available. Some other things about this bill before we get into cost is the new rate, if authorized by legislation, would not be paid until people are actually occupying the new homes. The Home for Creative Living would undertake construction of the homes, and at which point people would leave their current home, those beds would transfer, and then the new rate would be in effect in the new residence. Obviously, looking at the economic impact, we feel that the economic impact of these new homes would be relatively immediate to the communities in which they are built, not only for the jobs from construction, but also the ongoing property taxes and just people and additional people living in the community, the cost of building supplies, furnishing the home, things like that. And again, real quickly, what we're looking for, and I believe the amendment would specify the current rate of the facility, which is 274.62. The amendment would request an increase to $296.89 per person to cover the cost of the new homes. The annual cost, at which point all three of these homes would be up and running and fully occupied, the state's cost would be $73,156.95 per year. That's the state's share of the Medicaid funding. So I know I spoke rather quickly, but I'd like to leave time for any questions.
Is the amount reduced because of the amendment? Because the fiscal note that we have shows a higher state cost than you just indicated.
I believe the original bill had an ICFMR cost development funding formula that's no longer in use, and the amendment simply lists the existing rate and what the future rate would need to be to accommodate. And yes, and so that the rate in the amendment would be correct. We're looking at an additional $22.27 per day to the rate to fund the cost of the new housing.
Are there other questions? Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nelson, this is a private nonprofit operation?
It's a private proprietary. organization.
It is. And Madam Chair, is this a typical way for us to fund a private or for-profit operation through with state funds this way?
Senator Prettner, Solon, these are all considered facilities that serve public patients, regardless of how. It's just like we have some for-profit nursing homes. We don't. We pay for them the same way we pay for the others. And, you know, we're hearing this bill today as a courtesy to Senator Vickerman and his witnesses, but everyone here knows that it's going to be very difficult for us to find dollars for new spending. So the question that I have for you is what happens if we can't do this year? What if we have to wait a year or two more?
We have, you know, the next big, like I mentioned earlier, when they, in 2012, we either have to spend a considerable amount of money to replace the elevator or else we'd have to do something else. And we'd have to make a decision at that time. You know, anybody that, and Senator Vickerman has seen the building. He's been there numerous times and knows it's a great building, but it no longer works as a home for people. Then we'd have to make a decision and what where those people would go. So, yes, we do have a short window of time, which is why we started the process last year. And we hope to get something done this year. If not, we'll have to be back.
Okay, any other questions?
Okay.
I guess not. We can adopt your amendment, though, Senator Vickerman. Now we have a quorum. And Senator Rosen moved adoption of the A1 amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. And so we'll just set this bill aside, and we'll get a revised fiscal note. And as things go along, we'll see what we can do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thanks for your patience. And I know you and I both know we're in a difficult situation. So hopefully miracles happen. I've been around when miracles happen. So.
We need a few. Much. So if you see any out there, send them our way. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1369. Senator Murphy, is he here? Well, the purpose of the hearing on this bill is simply to hear the testimony because we don't have a fiscal note ready on the bill yet, but we thought... as you know, we're scheduling to get fiscal notes this year. It's a very interesting process. And since, we just got it. Okay. So we do have a fiscal note. We haven't had a chance to look at it, but we have it. So let's go ahead with the testimony without Senator Murphy, and then we'll see if we need to go get him. We will do that.
Thank you very much, committee. My name is Kevin Rymanowski. I'm with the Benedictine Health System, who has a facility in Red Wing, and what Senate File 1369 contemplates is the redesign of senior services in Red Wing and Goodyear County as a whole, and proposes the closure and relocation of two existing facilities in the community and downsizing those facilities to a new nursing facility to be constructed on the campus of the Red Wing Fairview Hospital. Currently, the two nursing facilities, Fairview Seminary Home is an 84-bed licensed facility. St. Bridget's at High Park is a 65-bed licensed nursing facility. So we have 100 and between those two beds and downsizing to an 80-bed facility, we're proposing the closure, permanent closure of 69 licensed beds. Currently, the two facilities serve 127 individuals, and so we're going to see a downsizing in the occupied beds in Goodyear County too, using the average Medicaid occupancy percentage of individuals of the medical assistance population. We're projecting that there will be roughly 23.7 on average fewer medical or residents receiving medical assistance in the new facility. And this bill contemplates taking the savings from those two.
Sorry. No, that's okay.
contemplates taking the savings from those 23.7 fewer people in the nursing facilities and splitting that cost savings between the new facility to allow for us to construct it and build it and pay for the property costs, and then give some back to the state also. Currently in the Fairview Seminary home serves an average of 31 people receive medical assistance. Annual cost for those people are $62,765. In St. Bridget's, they have an average occupancy of 28 individuals receiving medical assistance, with a state annual medical assistance cost of $62,105. So between those two facilities, we have 59 people receiving $62,453 annually, or a total of just shy of $3.7 million. For an annual basis for medical assistance going to those two facilities. What we're proposing by the legislation is to take the savings relating to those 23 people that will no longer be in the nursing facility, as we discussed, or as I mentioned previously, assuming that they will be served in the community in a waivered service or whatever, which has a different cost, and taking the savings of those people and allocating that to a rate increase to the new facility, and then, as I said, give 20% of it back to the state. So that in the new, in the Fostering Healthy Seniors proposal, we're saying that the cost of the residents in the new nursing facility is just as $84,589 on an annual cost. But the cost of people in the community is $20,000, just shy of $21,000, for an average cost of $59,134, less than the $62,000 that are currently being paid to the two facilities. So total annual cost of the new program would be roughly $3.5 million. So our proposal would be to take the current facilities are receiving $3.7 million annually for medical assistance recipients. In the future, we're proposing it will be $3.5 million, so a $200,000 savings. Unfortunately, it's not the $30.9 million that we heard at the beginning of the session here, but it would result in a net savings to the state of $200,000.
So we're going to give you a minute to look at the fiscal note, which we just got ourselves, while we have Senator Murphy address the amendment. He has an A2 amendment.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I do have the A2 amendment, and it is simply a technical amendment, Madam Chair. And Mr. Giel also wrote me a short note that it just simply relocates the new language into the appropriate chapter. Is that?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's purely technical.
So Senator Pretner Solon will move adoption of the amendment for Senator Murphy. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And
Madam
in regard Chair. To the fiscal note, Senator Murphy, it looks like where your calculations are going wrong with your witness is that there has been a failure to calculate into the savings and or losses the nursing home surcharge fee that's lost when you close the beds. And my suggestion would be that you take the fiscal note and you look at whether you can jiggle this around a little bit, so that maybe you can at least get it to come out neutral.
Okay.
We were looking forward to the 20% savings, believe me. But if we can't get there, you know, let's try to at least get it to zero if we can.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, to that point, and this is nothing against the two facilities that are joining, that are collaborating in this effort, but if one of them just closed, then how much of a cost to the state would that be?
Well, Senator Murphy, nursing homes do close in Minnesota periodically.
I know. I had one close in my district, Madam Chair, the one in Zumbrota, and we're trying to avoid closing more.
And when that happens, It is figured into the forecast. So, you know, it's just like anything else, if we have more people going into nursing homes, that's figured into the forecast also. But when we do something deliberately that changes things, then we do have to account for the savings and the loss. I can't just ignore this fiscal note, in other words. But
yeah.
Well, I do think this is a very worthwhile project, mm-hmm. and I'm hoping that your folks that have been working with you on it can take mm-hmm. this information, and perhaps we can put you on another agenda if you are able to rework this in the next week.
All right, Madam Chair, that's exactly what we'll do, and hopefully we'll be back in front of you. And this is a good project, members, and you know, the folks at each facility and the county and the city have all worked a long time, and they've worked very hard to try to make this happen. And not only for you know, fiscal sanity, but also for quality of care. And I think that that was the major driver here. It was not about dollars. It was about providing a better, more appropriate service. And having a facility that is, you know, basically across the sidewalk from our medical facility is a great location. You know, and the community is looking forward to moving on this as soon as possible. So we'll figure this out. And, Madam Chair, just so that the committee is aware, you know, I've had several bills this year where the fiscal note showed up like today. The fiscal note showed up, I think I was handed as I was walking up the steps
Senator
to the meeting.
Senator Murphy, we actually didn't anticipate we would even have it. We mm-hmm. were going to schedule your bill to get it. And then when we didn't think we were going to get it, we didn't want your witness to have to go home without telling us about your projects. So we decided we'd go ahead and schedule it, and then we'd wait and get the fiscal note later. At least what we have done here is get you a fiscal note in time that you might be able to do something to save your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My point was is that every committee that I've been to, the fiscal notes are all late.
I understand the problem. I'm suffering enormously with the same
Maybe we shouldn't
issue.
Be cutting government services as much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the work on this project. Next, we have Senate File 203, Senator Kubley. Mm-hmm. This is a fee-supported bill, so does not affect the general fund, but I do understand that the policy in it might be somewhat controversial. So we have asked people who are going to testify in favor and against any bills today to be as brief as possible. Welcome, Senator Kubley.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. You know, this bill was not controversial when it passed last year, so I guess, you know, it's been a little bewildering to me, but you know, I think there is a handout in your packets, members, that kind of explains the cost piece of the bill and how that has been agreed to with the rural health cooperative that's being represented in the bill. I think, you know, there are simply pieces in the bill that deal with state oversight. That's the primary indication of the bill or purpose of the bill. But the fiscal note on it is rather small, and it deals only with the payment that will be made by the Rural Health Cooperative to the department for the oversight that they provide. And so, you know, it's not a large fiscal note, but there is one that is presented to you. With me today is a former member of this body, Senator Moe, and he can make a few comments on the bill as well.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Moe, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. 15 years ago, the legislature found that locally based and controlled efforts among healthcare providers, local businesses, units of local government, and healthcare consumers can promote the attainment of the legislature's goal of healthcare reform and take notice of the long history of successful operations of cooperative organizations in this state. From that, they created the Minnesota Healthcare Cooperative Act, and from that act has been created the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. It is a 23 critical access hospitals, 24 primary care clinics, and 10 specialty clinics that are located in the southwest, west-central part of the state. It reaches almost up to my neighborhood, with the farthest north critical access hospital is in Manoman. The proposed legislation does not create some new antitrust exemption. The antitrust exemption in the Minnesota Cooperative Statute has existed for 15 years. Healthcare cooperatives have acted under the statute for that period of time. This proposed legislation does not create a new exemption, but simply strengthens the level of supervision of the negotiating process to both alleviate the concerns about unjustified higher prices and to ensure protection against antitrust actions that could destroy all the benefits that healthcare cooperatives have provided to Minnesota rural residents. This bill, as I said, does not create any new abilities for the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. It doesn't change their membership at all. It simply allows them to continue what they've been doing for the past 15 years. As Senator Kubley has indicated, the costs of what they project to be about $2,000 per review and then follow-up, the $500 follow-up, the Department of Health has indicated that that is an appropriate amount and that the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative will has agreed to fully fund those costs. Thank you very much. I urge your support for Senate File 203.
Are there any questions? Okay, then let's hear from Thomas Purcell at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Purcell. I'm a partner with the Lindquist and Venom Law Firm in Minneapolis, and I've been practicing healthcare antitrust law for over 20 years in this city, including as a member of the Attorney General's staff who was in charge of antitrust enforcement for many years during the first round of healthcare reform back in the late 80s and early 90s. I will tell you that at that time, the subject of the connection between antitrust law and potentially anti-competitive activity and cooperatives and the kind of joint contracting that we see at issue in the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative was also an issue, and the legislature passed and carefully considered a comprehensive statute at that time, which was then codified at Minnesota Statute 62J.2911 through 21, which had the kind of process in it that is really necessary to protect consumers from the potentially anti-competitive effects of groups like the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative. Some of the committee members may be aware that as the healthcare cooperative itself has announced, this group has been under investigation for some time by the Federal Trade Commission. And the Federal Trade Commission, I have copies here for any members who don't have it, has written a comprehensive 10-page letter to a member of the House of Representatives opposing this legislation and opposing it on two essential grounds. Number one, it will cost the state money. The Federal Trade Commission experience has been that the kind of collective negotiation that these folks want to do, which is vastly different from the kind of collective negotiations embodied in agricultural co-ops around the state, will increase the cost of health care to all buyers, not just to health plans, but to all buyers, including individual consumers. So that's, I think, a huge reason to oppose this bill. I will tell you that this is not just a theoretical concern coming from Washington based on an investigation of these groups. It is also a practical concern and a reality that the health plans face as they negotiate or attempt to negotiate consumer-friendly, low health care costs in southwestern Minnesota. I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and their members, one in particular, have been negotiating with this group over the last several years and seen a real sea change in the way that they operate, and that the way that they operate now amounts to the kind of activity that the Federal Trade Commission in this letter characterizes as price fixing, as collusion. This is an activity which does not benefit the state. There are some things which this healthcare cooperative does and which are authorized by the original Chapter 62R under which they operate, which are indeed beneficial. They've talked in the past about joint credentialing and joint quality projects and so forth. No antitrust immunity, which is what this bill seeks, would be necessary for those kinds of activities. And indeed, in the Federal Trade Commission letter, these activities aren't mentioned at all. It's the joint contracting, which amounts to a bunch of competitors getting in a room together, deciding what prices they're going to charge, and warning the health plans that if they don't accept these prices, there will be no contract, that is really at issue. Senator and members of the committee, I can't tell you how strongly the health plans oppose this kind of activity. The health plans are doing nothing except buying health care and trying to pass it along at the lowest possible costs to consumers, to employers who buy health care, health insurance, and individuals who buy health insurance. And if the prices go up, which is exactly what will happen and what is the rationale for this activity, those prices have to be passed along to consumers, not just in that area, but potentially statewide. I will also say that this will cost the state money in another respect. I'm familiar with the kind of workup of economic analysis that one has to do to decide whether an activity is going to be pro-consumer or anti-consumer under the antitrust laws. It's the kind of thing that antitrust lawyers do all the time when they work up cases. This is a process that takes months and months with economists and attorneys working on the file, which the Federal Trade Commission, by the way, has taken 2.5 years to do in considering this matter, and which it's impossible for me to believe that the health department could do for $2,000 or for $500 for a renewal application. In the original legislation, which was passed in 1993 and gave the health department full and appropriate ability to protect consumers, the process was much more rigorous. It included the opportunity for public comment, for interested parties to participate. It included the possibility that there might have to be litigation on contested issues. But most of all, it gave everybody a chance to openly participate in a process that it would be heard very summarily under this bill. That's the kind of consumer protection that we need if there are going to be antitrust immunities given to healthcare providers, and that's the kind of immunity that we support.
Senator Prentner-Sullivan.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name, but
Thomas Purcell.
Mr. Purcell, I was amused by one of your comments, and maybe I misheard you. I thought you said that they said this is the price that we're willing to pay, and you either take it or leave it. But isn't that exactly what the health plans do to small groups of providers in the communities? That you go to them and you say, this is the price we'll pay, and if you don't want it, then you'll just have to leave it.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Sullivan, the kind of activity that when a powerful buyer says, goes out and bargains for prices, that activity is not unlawful. Whereas if a bunch of competitors get together and decide the price at which they're going to sell, that is literally a violation of the antitrust laws. In an only slightly different context, you may recall back from the mid-'80s that the state of Minnesota was prosecuting highway contractors who got together and told the state what prices they were going to let contracts at. The state's a powerful buyer that tries to keep prices down for the benefit of its taxpayers. The health plans are in no different position than that.
Any other questions? I guess I was wondering, in the past, has there been a difference in the prices negotiated in with providers in this group that are noticeably higher than prices that are negotiated with other similar groups?
Madam Chair, yes, there have been, and we'd be happy to submit to you and to the members a letter with details. I'll just give you a few examples. The clinics in this area receive reimbursement at 140% of what the clinics in similar areas do, their peers in other areas of the state, and reimbursements that are higher than the other clinics in the region as well. That's simply one example of the kind of higher prices that have, in fact, resulted from this activity.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I disagree with Mr. Purcell's comments. In fact, if you look at number 6 on this handout, you know, there is a typo there, but it states that MRHC member costs, that word should be charges. On the average, they are lower than the Minnesota state average, with some individual costs being considerably lower, about 60% less than the average. You know, I think, you know, it does seem to me that, you know, many of the health plans that Mr. Purcell represents are, in fact, members of this rural health cooperative. You know, it gave them access to a market that, you know, in sparsely populated areas that they were not pursuing without it. You know, so, it, you know, to me it seems almost antithetical that they would come and testify against it. It seems to me that what Senator Pretner Solon said is the way the health plans operate, not the way this co-op is operated. You know, they're trying to provide access to health care in areas at a decent price, you know, where the population is so sparse that most of the health plans, with the exception of the Blues, have not operated in the past. And I've said it in the other committees that this bill has gone through, that, you know, if those health plans are interested in and willing to provide the same services for a lower price, why aren't they pulling out of the health care cooperative and offering their product at that lower price that they feel is more competitive? You know, the comments that Mr. Purcell makes, from my perspective at least, really don't hold water. You know, they're very, you know, they're the antithesis of the reasons this cooperative was formed and the way they have functioned over the years.
So is there someone here from the Department of Health agency that would have the duty to review these contracts? You want to identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Julie Sonier from the Minnesota Department of Health.
So the question that I have is, in reviewing these contracts, how would you be able to identify whether prices were increasing and that the power of the collective group was causing antitrust to occur?
Madam Chair, we would collect information both from the co-op itself, but also from health plans and other providers in the area that are not part of the co-op, and we would anticipate using that information to be able to look comparatively at the prices, not charges, but the actual prices that are being received by members of the co-op versus others in the area or in the surrounding area or you know, perhaps in other parts of the state, if we aren't able to identify any comparable providers locally.
Are there any other questions for the department?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Sonier, in your opinion, how does this work with the health care reform legislation that we passed last year as far as... to me, with the reform, we're trying to set up a competitive market, and competition is good. You know, so I just would like to know your spin on this.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, that's a good question. There's a number of ways that I think that it interacts with the health reforms from last year. Some of them positive, and some of them potentially negative. So, for example, we're looking at promoting the use of information technology, or promoting better capacity to do quality measurements. And you can think about small providers being able to do perhaps a better job of that, working cooperatively. But you're right that there is some potential that, particularly when you are negotiating prices collectively, I think the concern about costs is a real and legitimate one. What this bill asks the department to do is to balance those factors against each other and to make a conclusion about whether the positive market impacts outweigh the potential negative ones from the arrangement, and base the determination on the balance between those kinds of issues.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I'm not sure if this is similar to some legislation I carried when I was early in the legislature, and I've been trying ever since I first heard your bill to, I think it was called a MIWA, is that correct? I'm just wondering if it's similar to that same type of cooperative insurance for small groups. We had one that was that they had in Duluth too, was Bridgewater.
Senator Prettner-Solon, a MIWA is a method of purchasing insurance by bringing small groups together. This is a method of establishing rates with health plans for providers. So they're okay. Not, it's kind of apples and oranges. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I don't know what your intent with this bill is, but I would think any investigation from the FTC is fairly serious and should be taken gingerly. We should be very careful about what we do here. And so I'm not sure if you plan on laying this bill over or having a vote on it, but I would just like to state that for the record.
My intention would not to have this in the omnibus bill. It is a fee-supported bill, so it can go separately. And, of course, that gives legislators the opportunity to vote on it separately.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
We don't really know how much this is going to cost the state. If there is, there are some allegations that there are alleged, costs to the state on this. And so... potential cost to the state.
Well, is there anyone here from the Department of Human Services that deals with the PMAP contracts?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Karen Pete. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I apologize. I did not hear the question.
I didn't ask a question. Oh, I just asked if you were here, and you are.
Yes, I am. Oh, can I go back to my chair now?
No. You did exactly what we wanted you to do. You came up to the table.
This is my lamb to the slaughter pin, Madam Chair.
Yes, well, I'm going to find out where you got it. The question is whether rate increases that are given to this type of organization in the negotiations with the managed care plans would be reflected then in increases in PMAP rates for our public program or for our other programs, Minnesota Care, et cetera.
Madam Chair, are you asking if the legislature approves a payment increase to this particular type of on a fee-for-service basis, whether we would pass that through?
No, Ms. Pede. This bill does not have a rate increase in it. It is a mechanism by which organizations that provide health care services can collectively negotiate their rates with health plan companies. The concern that has been raised is that this tends to increase the rates that the health care providers are receiving. But I am not sure if there is a connection between the rates that they would be receiving and what the rates would be that we negotiate with the health plan.
I see.
So the question is there any connection? Is there, so would this potentially have the impact of increasing costs to the state programs?
Madam Chair, to the extent that these groups negotiated with health plans or that health plans negotiated with these groups for public program enrollees, and to the extent that the groups were successful in negotiating higher rates, eventually that would show up in our payments.
Well, Ms. Pede, then you, the Department of Human Services hasn't done a fiscal note on this bill. Do you believe that you should be asked to do one?
Madam Chair, I hesitate to volunteer to do yet another fiscal note, but if I would be happy to review it and respond.
All right. Why don't we just set your bill aside for a few minutes, Senator Kubley, and let her do that.
All right.
We'll come back to you. Okay. So the next bill that we have on our agenda is... The author is not available at the moment, so we will go to Senate File 7. You're not the next one, dear.
We're sorry. We were told we were next.
Senator Marty is the next one, and he's not available. So Senate File 1709, Senator Ortman would be the next bill.
I think we have good timing. Chair and members, Senator Higgins, a co-author, has joined me as well. We're just up from the Judiciary Committee, so we'll be heading back there when we're done.
And to Senator Ortman, if you've seen the fiscal note, that's really what we're interested in, and whether and how much the fees for the Board of Pharmacy would have to be increased as a result of this legislation.
Madam Chair, if I could, the fiscal note shows that there will be a cost for the startup of this program, approximately $1.5 million to procure the types of prescription pads that we're talking about in sufficient quantity to supply all of the physicians in the state of Minnesota for all of their prescription uses. Right now, Minnesota is expected to use these types of tamper-resistant pads for medical assistance, but not all not all physicians do. It's recommended on the website, but it's not actual practice. So if you look at what it would take to take them from their current practice level to a mandated requirement of using these tamper-proof prescription pads, it would be a procurement cost of $1.5 million. Unfortunately, Madam Chair and members, the fiscal note does not address what the cost savings would be, and that's honestly a little bit frustrating in the fiscal note, because that's the whole purpose, is that there will be systematic savings recognized by both the insurance industry, the Insurance Federation. Bob Johnson is supporting this legislation for that reason, because there is expected to be savings not only in prescription fraud, but also savings in the aspects and costs to society, given the prescription drug abuse that's rampant in our society. So the 1.5 is the significant cost, along with the cost of having two clerical folks to manage the program. And then there are some startup equipment costs. I think those are outlined in the fiscal note as well. But I think it's unfortunate that we have to guess at the savings, but the state of New York has definitely identified savings in their system as a result of putting these tamper-resistant prescription pads in place. New York recognized, I think we have it in the facts here, in this pamphlet that was handed out to you, more than $140 million in Medicaid fraud savings was generated in the state of New York. Applying that same methodology to what might happen in Minnesota, given the use of prescriptions, we're looking at a $15 to $30 million savings in the system in the first couple of years. So I think that upfront cost of $1.5 to $2 million would be well spent. And again, I think it's unfortunate the department has not talked about the fraud that would be identified and saved in the system.
Senator Ortman, we do have a fiscal note from the Department of Human Services, and they indicate that they already are required pharmacists or, prescribers are already required to use these kind of pads in our medical assistance program. So there would be no savings to the state above what we get from the program already. When there are savings to the private sector, unfortunately, we have not been able to figure out how to return any of those savings to the state to offset costs of programs that might have savings.
Madam Chair, the requirements that they use the prescription pads that currently exist are medical assistance cases and not in other types of cases, and so there definitely would be savings when this program is implemented there. And then it's not certain that there's full compliance with the medical assistance requirement as well, that there are some that are using regular pads now. So what we're trying to get is 100% consistency with one type of pad in use, and they're certain to generate some savings, some at the state level, certainly in the private sector as well. And I think they're important savings. And then there's the department has its own division or unit that works on fraud and works on prescription fraud. They're not going to say that there's additional savings there, but I believe that if you implement a new system like this where you can identify additional ways to capture those fraudulent transactions, that there will be a savings there as well. And I believe that's the part that's underestimated here.
Well, Senator Ortman, I'm happy to have you continue working with the Department of Human Services if you believe that they have underestimated the impact of the fiscal note. But until I get some savings from them, we can't count it. And we do have, you know, we do have a fiscal note from the Board of Pharmacy in regard to the costs they would need to implement the program. You're not disputing the Board of Pharmacy fiscal note, are you?
No, Madam Chair, I certainly would not do that. But I would add one thing that's been brought to my attention, and that's that the medical assistance requirements aren't as strict with their prescription pads as we might be. There's a higher level of security with these pads that we'd be talking about that might also provide some savings in the potential fraudulent transactions between the pads that are currently in use for medical assistance cases and the ones that we're proposing here because of this heightened level of security. And you'll see in this pamphlet, in case you're looking for more background information about that, it's on page 6, which talks about the steps that would be implemented with these new tamper-resistant pads. The first is to simplify by requiring one prescription format. The second would be to secure only authorized prescribers, so there's no one out there with access to a pad that shouldn't actually qualify for one, and then validating through automation processes. So that's what we're trying to get at, members. I have been given an A2 amendment that I think that it is a good suggestion from committee administrator here about the appropriation aspect of this, Madam Chair, which would allow a little bit of flexibility.
Madam Chair, I'll move that A2 amendment.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. So members, this amendment would appropriate general fund money to the Board of Pharmacy to pay for this and would get rid of the idea in the bill that this could be paid for out of any stimulus money, since there really isn't any to pay for it with. And it would direct the Board of Pharmacy to seek private and other federal sources to implement this program. I'm not sure if Mr. Weiberg, do you want to come up to the table for a minute just to answer a question about this? Mr. Weiberg, are you aware of private or federal sources of funds that might allow you to implement this?
Madam Chair, no, I'm not at this point. I'm not aware of any federal or private funds that would be available to pay for tamper-resistant pads. My understanding is that when Congress passed the federal legislation that requires tamper-resistant pad for Medicaid patients, there was no money provided for prescribers or clinics or whatever to purchase those pads. I might also add, since I'm here, that my understanding is that, at least from the feedback we're getting from pharmacies, is that most prescribers in the state have switched to tamper-resistant pads for all of their patients because they don't want to have to distinguish between Medicaid patients and regular patients when they're in the exam room getting ready to write out a prescription.
So just to make it easier so they don't have to figure it out.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Could I ask Mr. Weiberg where they get the tamper-resistant pads that they use now?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, from a variety of vendors. They purchase them themselves.
Madam Chair, I think that's the point, is that if the Department of Health were to manage this program, then we would have them all numbered. We would know exactly where they've gone. They've been distributed specifically to our physicians, and so that we can manage the fraud on that end as well. I think that's the whole point. I also have a testifier here, Madam Chair, who can speak directly to the distinction between what the current practice is in the state of Minnesota and what's being proposed here and about where that savings might be.
Senator Artman, I'd like you to have that person discuss this with the Department of Human Services on your own time, because we have a very long agenda. And I indicated to you, if you can get some savings that can be produced in a fiscal note, that we'd be happy to consider that. At this point, we don't have it. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Orton, do you have an implementation date on this bill when this needs to be enacted?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I think that's a good point here. I'm not sure that it's included, and that might be because after the first engrossment we made a couple of changes. Maybe it just didn't get transferred here, but it would be along with every other legislative change that we made effective August 1.
Okay, Madam Chair, and Senator Orton, that was the reason I asked, is because and I would like to have you just address it at some point, too, the e-prescribing legislation that has to be in place by 2011 and the enactment on the date of enactment on this bill. And there's going to be about a year where these forms will be viable. And could you address
that? Mr. Weiberg, do you want to address that?
If I might address the implementation date. The fiscal note from the board does assume that we're going to have to do some work with the vendor. The reason some other materials I've seen about this that have been distributed, I don't know if members have it, talk about a fiscal note that was done in Indiana where their equivalent agency wanted 10 new staff members. Ours assumes 2, and it assumes 2 because we'll have to work with the vendor. Frankly, even if the legislation was passed today and became effective tomorrow, we would not have time to do the required request for proposals and get a contract with the vendor in place by August 1st. So the earliest implementation date I could see for this would be January of next year.
Madam Chair.
Senator Orton.
If I could just address the e-prescribe issue. E-prescribe will, if it becomes effective in the state of Minnesota, and we know we have the mandate to do that, but the DEA has not necessarily issued rules in support of the e-prescribe system yet. But even once we do, it won't cover all prescriptions. I mean, e-prescribe will probably cover many of them, but not 100%, and there will still be pads for prescriptions in doctor's offices, and there will still be pads with prescriptions that are, you know, prescriptions by hand that will go to pharmacies. And if we're heading in this direction, I think that we should do all we can to take out the fraud from the system. And I think a statutory plan to do this now makes a lot of sense, given the savings in the short term and in the long term.
Okay, well, members, are there any more questions about the amendment? We're ready to vote on the amendment then.
This is a question about the amendment, Madam Chair. It's also about the bill, but I'm curious why we would assume that we need to buy these pads for the providers through the pharmacy board. I mean, providers buy their own pads today, don't they? I mean, that's the lion's share of the fiscal note that we're given here, and it's
Lori, my understanding is that somebody has to number these. That if you just go buy your own, they're not, there's no number on it, so it can't be traced.
So then because they have to be numbered, the board has to buy them and can't pass any of those costs on to the, I mean, right now providers, Madam Chair, buy their own prescription pads, and I don't think they pay for them. I don't know. That is the major cost driver of this here, and there's an underlying assumption that the pharmacy board would take over purchasing pads for all prescribers throughout the state, and I'm just questioning whether that's actually what's being proposed here or not. I guess that would be to the authors. And
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Lori, that is exactly the value of this program, is to having all of these prescription pads numbered so that they are traceable right back to the person that's issued those pads, so that you can, if there's fraud in, you know, God forbid, in the doctor's office, you can trace it back to the doctor's office. Where in the process did something occur here? So that's why the state has an interest in it. There's no reason why the department couldn't charge doctors a fee for these prescriptions. I mean, I suppose that's a possibility, and we'll keep working with the department. Maybe that might be something that they'd be interested in doing. There are always costs with collection, though, and administrating programs like that and collecting the fees for the pads. I mean, I'm new in this area. That's why I have my mentor here with me, because this is definitely a new area of the law for me. But I think that if we can identify ways to save and we can identify ways to avoid this fraud, we should. And I think this is a great start.
And I'm trying to help.
Thank you, Senator Lori.
So if the Board of Pharmacy was going to be able to charge physicians, that would have to be authorized in the bill. Currently, they have no authority for that. So why don't we vote on this amendment, and then I think we can maybe set the bill aside and see if the author wants to do some more work on it, and we'll see if at this point in time we don't have this money to fund this. So I mean, I think we should just be clear up front about that. We didn't know what the cost would be, and we didn't know if it would have any savings, and that's why we asked for a fiscal note, and that's why we scheduled the bill. But at this point, we aren't going to have general fund money to fund this with.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
You could, if you wanted to, you haven't adopted the A2 yet, correct?
No, we haven't.
You could, if you wanted to, add just a simple sentence, maybe as just a placeholder. The Board of Pharmacy is authorized to charge a reasonable fee for the prescription pads, and then an effective date.
But we still would have to have the Board of Pharmacy do a new fiscal note for us.
Right. But he's so close. He's very, very close.
So if you...
We're winning him over.
If you want to keep working with them on that idea, that would be fine. Right now, this is what we have in front of us. So let's vote on this amendment, and then we'll set the bill aside.
Let's ask the authors if they want us to vote on this amendment. I mean, do you want this amendment to go on before you've done that extra work, or...
Madam Chair, we can do that as a separate amendment as well, I'm sure.
So, any more discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the amendment is adopted. And we'll just set this aside, and people can keep working on it, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Maybe Cooper's coming back.
So, Katie, while you draft up, is that what they decided?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do. They're going off.
Representative Cooper? I mean, Senator Cooper? Sorry. I gave you a promotion there.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure about promotions. I've been in both chambers. They seem fairly similar to me, but.
The department, Ms. Pete, has had a chance to look at this. Do you want to come back up and tell us what you think? And also in regard to the letter from the FTC, if you believe that this will be causing prices to increase and driving the trend in the forecast for the public health programs.
Madam Chair and members, we don't believe that it would be necessary for us to fiscal note this bill. There would be nothing in it that we could take hold of to derive a fiscal note for. We believe that if increases were to occur as a result of this, that they would be picked up in the forecast in the trend. So it's an if then proposition.
Right, but it could cause the forecast to increase?
Madam Chair, under current circumstances with what I understand to be a single cooperative, it's unlikely. If there were multiple cooperatives, I suppose it's possible, but I can't derive a definite cause.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, you know, just in response to the FTC questions, I mean, the FTC generally provided their initial inquiry into the healthcare cooperative because of some pharmacies that were members. That was the only issue they raised initially, and those pharmacies are no longer members. That's part of what is bewildering to me, I guess, in terms of the contact that they've had. Although, you know, I think it's good for members to keep in mind that the healthcare cooperative initially brought the health plans into the market. They were looking for a way to be involved in the market since Blue Cross and Blue Shield were the only people out there providing the access to services that were needed. And so this was seen as a way to give them a competitive edge to enter the market, and that has worked out well for 15 years.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 203 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
I believe that the bill does pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We'll revert to Senator Marty's bill then.
Senator Marty, Senate File 1558.
Senator
you.
Marty.
I apologize. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 1558 is a bill that came out of the Legislative Commission on Ending Poverty, which issued its report in January of this year. I think it is groundbreaking work. It was a bipartisan commission, came to agreement on many difficult to agree upon things. And one of the recommendations of it is that we monitor how we're doing, and part of that was that we monitor the impact of legislation on poverty, whether bills are having an impact in a positive manner or a negative manner on the well-being of low-income Minnesotans. And this legislation was drafted to do that. We would be giving request the chairs or ranking minority members of legislative committees the ability to request, like a fiscal note, request a poverty impact statement of legislation if it would impact a significant number of people in poverty. And we would be using state demographer's office. They would be the lead in performing these. The difference between fiscal notes, they're obviously designed to determine the impact on the state budget of legislation. This would be to determine the impact on people in poverty and low-income working people in Minnesota. We have one oral amendment and one written amendment we'd like to have added to the bill to make it work right. And I have Deborah Schlick from Affirmative Options Coalition here and Tom Gillespie, the state demographer, who could briefly comment on the bill.
Senator Marty, why don't we do your amendments?
There's an A2 amendment out there, I believe. I don't know if it's been distributed.
Senator Prettner-Solon moves the adoption of the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted.
And, Madam Chair, the other one's an oral amendment. It would be on page 1, line 12, strike the and insert a. So it's as measured by a National Academy of Sciences modernized poverty measure. And then before the period on line 13, insert selected by the state demographer.
Senator Marty offers the oral amendment on lines 1.12 and 1.13. Any discussion? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I'll offer that for Senator Marty.
Thank you.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the oral amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, Senator Marty, we're asking people to limit their testimony, and we've asked for people only to have one witness. So,
okay. You guys choose 1 minute.
And I'd also be happy to offer that if there's questions.
Go ahead. They're happy to respond if there are questions. Mr. Gillespie mentioned that he's been dealing with people at the Center for Poverty Research in University of Wisconsin who are very excited that some state might actually be trying to measure something like this. And I'll also add that the fiscal note you have, I thought it was the newer one because it's the one that the Department of Human Services now says is accurate. They had some concern that we were asking them to hire some economists and so on. We clarified that with the state demographer's office, and so they said the $3,000 estimate is a fair one.
That's correct. So are there any questions about the fiscal note or the bill before us? Apparently there are not. So, Senator Marty, we'll lay this bill aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the division.
All right. Next on our agenda is Senator Prettner-Solon. Just so members understand, my understanding of Senator Prettner-Solon's intention with this bill is to delete all of the sections with fiscal impact and to move those sections that have no fiscal impact forward.
Madam Chair, we have had a discussion about that, and basically what we have adopted are the governor's recommendations, some of his spending recommendations, and some of his savings recommendations.
Right, but that would be considered, Senator Prettner-Solon, that would be considered as a part of the omnibus bill, and we have not eliminated the governor's proposals from the table. So we can have those taken up at when we take up the budget. You have other provisions in your bill that don't have any fiscal impact, is my understanding. And so those could move forward on their own.
Yes. Madam Chair, may I have Ms. Henry speak with you about that?
Madam Chair and Henry. Members, my name is Ann Henry. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center Legal Aid Society. I think that one of the issues with trying to do that, we had hoped to do that, is that the language that is in the amendment is in large part language from the Department of Human Services to reform the PCA program and MA home care. I have been told just a bit ago that there are some provisions in here besides the financial ones that the department has problems with. I guess what I would like the committee to consider is the fact that this language is the Office of the Legislative Auditor changes combined with Department of Human Services reform of the program and giving them better management tools for the PCA program especially. I think we're well aware that there will be cuts considered to the program, but cuts to the program we think should be done on the basis of this recodified and reorganized language, that as we move ahead, things would work better if we could do that.
Well, Ms. Henry, if the department has concerns about the bill, they can come forward and say what they are, and we can decide whether we think their concerns are meritorious or not. We don't do everything around here just because the department doesn't like it or does like it.
Madam Chair, it's, as others have expressed, very frustrating working without fiscal notes and believing that we have everybody involved in trying to put this together so it'll work out.
I understand. And, you know, many people have thought this is the only thing that we can have to talk about PCA programs, and that's just not true. This bill is not the only opportunity. We have the entire budget, and we have amendments that can be offered to the budget. But if there are things in here that people think are a good idea that don't have any fiscal impact, then we should try and do something to move those ideas forward.
Madam Chair, we'll come back later then.
Okay, we'll set this one aside. Senator Prettner-Solon has the next bill, 1099. Do you want to take it now or later as well?
Madam Chair, I'll take this. It has problems too. I just received a fiscal note on this too, so. And I also have a delete everything amendment. It's the A3 amendment. We have been working with the departments and the health plans and putting something together. We have moved closer to agreement, but there is not entire agreement on this. Earlier this year, I met with leadership at SMDC, St. Mary's Duluth Clinic Health System, to discuss how the downturn in the economy has financially stressed our hospitals and healthcare systems. And during that discussion, I was informed of an area in the healthcare system where savings can be captured through administrative simplification. This opportunity lies in the system where providers navigate the process seeking exceptions to health plan drug formularies and drug prior authorizations for the benefit of the patient. This legislation simply asks for two changes. First, that the health plans in Minnesota agree on a single format for drug formulary exceptions and separately prior authorizations. And second, that the paper and fax process be replaced with a secure electronic transmission process, which is in line with our healthcare reform initiatives. This will reduce the number of FTEs both providers and payers need to do this work. And with me today to provide you with additional information on this bill is Dr. Clark, who is a medical, his medical specialty is lung disease, but for the past 15 years, he's been one of the medical directors at the SMDC system. He has served on the board of directors of the Duluth Clinic, St. Mary's Medical Center, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and now Essentia Health. Yeah, he's also an adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine.
Hey, welcome. You want to give us your testimony?
Yes. Thank you very much, Senator Prettner-Solon. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Terry Clark, and I'm a physician at the Duluth Clinic. But today I speak on behalf of not just St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, but Mayo, Park Nicollet, Fairview, Alina, and the Minnesota Medical Association. Prescription drugs are an expensive item, so nearly all payers use drug formularies to help control utilization and costs. A formulary is simply a list of drugs paid for by insurance. A drug not on this list may be covered at a lower level or not at all. For some expensive drugs, payers require what's called prior authorization. This step requires the doctor to explain in writing exactly why the patient needs this drug and why nothing else will work. Another variation involves particular patients for whom the drugs on the formulary list have been tried but are not effective or are not tolerated due to side effects. In this situation, the doctor can request an exception to the formulary so the patient's bill will be paid. Unfortunately, all but one of the payers in Minnesota uses a method over 30 years old for this process. The request must be submitted on a paper form, which is then faxed to the payer. Each plan has its own form, and some plans have several different forms. It is difficult to overstate how wasteful it is of time and talent to have one of our skilled nurses abstract information from our electronic medical record, then fill out the paper form by hand and carry it to a fax machine. This process consumes 10 to 30 minutes per case. When, in contrast, a request submitted on a web-based form like the one used by Preferred One can be done in 3 minutes. At SMDC, we process over 1,200 of these requests each month. One reason for this large number is that the requests must be renewed every year, plus the number of drugs that are really expensive and the number of drugs that are alternatives for various conditions keeps growing. Our cost for this process at SMDC is about $500,000 per year. If the payers in Minnesota would replace the paper and fax system with an electronic system, I think this cost could be cut in half. There would be savings for all clinics, large and small. As Senator Prettner-Solon has said, some of the payers have reservations about this initiative. However, in recent weeks, we have had extensive discussions with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Minnesota Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services. The bill has been amended to accommodate their concerns. Earlier today, Mr. Golden of the Minnesota Department of Health stated, and I quote him, "We think this looks very feasible." And Ms. Drake of the Department of Human Services said, quote, "We look forward to working with the Administrative Uniformity Committee in the effort to streamline prior authorizations." I would be happy to address any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for Dr. Clark? Okay. Then, Senator, my understanding is that the Subdivision 5 of your amendment is going to add cost. You'd have to have a new fiscal note done that would increase the cost. Did you still want to adopt the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, I do. I wish to adopt the
Senator
Prettner-Solon
has moved the A3 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the amendment is adopted. Senator, I think we just need to set this aside also so that if you can work out fiscal impacts, that would be great. the ones in the Department of Human Services are as concerning as the ones in the Department of Health.
Yes, I know. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Prettner-Solon, you have the next bill if you wanted to.
I have a.
Take it up. It actually does have a fiscal note with savings.
Yes. Thank God.
Get one about every.
I wonder if I could do some. I wouldn't do that.
Every few dozen, we get one.
Hello. Before I describe this bill, that there is an amendment also. I'd like to offer the A2 amendment, and this just basically deletes Section 2 and 3 out of the bill. And this is being made to eliminate the negative fiscal impact from the bill.
Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
So, Madam
and
Chair.
And I believe the fiscal note has been done to the amended bill.
Yes.
Are there any questions about the fiscal note? If there are no questions about the fiscal note, then Senator Prettner-Solon will move. We'll set this aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, is she in the audience or in the room somewhere? Well, until we find her, why don't we go ahead and take some of my bills?
Berglund, do you have a preference which bill we take up?
Mr. Chairman, there's a few of these that we're just going to do amendments. We don't have fiscal notes, and we'd like to get the fiscal note done with
the amendment.
And so, Senate File 1442 would be one of those.
Senate File 1442. Do we have the amendment in our packet? We're having that distributed. This is not the first committee stop. So you can describe the amendment quickly while it's being distributed.
Mr. Chairman, this is an alternative benefit plan. It was modeled after a plan that was approved by the federal government in Idaho. And but they had more to their plan than just this basic benefit set for tier one recipients. They had also benefit plans for people with disabilities and people who were disabled with disabilities. And our intention was not to try to do that. We already have mechanisms for dealing with those other populations. And so this amendment was suggested by the department to make it clear that people must enroll in this basic health plan unless they've been identified by the commissioner as an applicant with special needs or as medically frail. And that with this amendment, then we would get a more realistic fiscal note in terms of savings. With the bill the way it stands now, they interpret it that people could choose what they want to be in and flip around all the time, and it would add costs, not reduce costs.
Senator Berglund renews her motion on the A3 amendment. On that amendment, questions of members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I believe I have another amendment, but I don't have it in my folder.
For this same bill?
I believe so. Is this the one we're doing the dental amendment on to? No? Okay. Sorry, I'm confused. So we can just set this aside then and hopefully get better
so we'll set
fiscal note on it.
Senate file 1442 aside pending a fiscal note. Not today, though. I mean, yeah, we'll get a fiscal note drafted. Okay.
Right. The next one is Senate file 2003.
Senate file 2003, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill deals with medication therapy management services for a select group of medical assistance recipients, ones that have been identified by some of our safety net providers as having very high costs because they are using multiple chronic conditions and a high number of medications, and they are able to be prevented from hospitalizations and emergency rooms and medication complications if they would be involved in an intensive medication therapy management program. And we do have a fiscal note on this bill showing a small savings. I guess that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. What is your intentions with this,
Mr. Chair?
Bill, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, where is the pilot project going to be based out of?
Well, this came to us from Hennepin County, but it isn't limited to Hennepin County, so.
You have a testifier. State your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Shannon Wright. I'm a clinical pharmacist at the Minnesota Visiting Nurse Agency, but also hold an assistant professor position with the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. The MVNA pharmacy program started when I joined MVNA in July 2007 as a pharmacy resident at the University of Minnesota. After the first year of the program, the University of Minnesota and MVNA agreed to continue their relationship and developed a joint faculty position, which I started in July 2008. MVNA provides nursing care in the homes of over 7,000 residents of Hennepin and Ramsey County each year. It serves as the public health nursing arm for the city of Minneapolis in Hennepin County and serves as the primary home care agency for HCMC. All of the work is grounded in public health. This was a perfect setting for me to build a home medication management practice. The majority of our patients have very limited resources and live below the poverty level. 80% live in Minneapolis or first-ring suburbs. Our adults and seniors who are ill have five or more acute and chronic illnesses when admitted, are over the age of 60, are taking 10-plus medications per day, and over half have cognitive issues or mental illness. 50% are minority. Over 80% live alone or their caregiver is disabled themselves. Because of the extreme poverty of our patients, MVNA has over 800 volunteers to provide material goods, such as food and clothing, for the patients who are in abject poverty. This is truly a public-private partnership to deliver care to the most needy, and the University of Minnesota is happy to be part of the delivery system. In my home care pharmacy practice, I spent the first year developing protocols, building relationships, and understanding home care. Now I do 5 to 10 visits per week and have done approximately 125 visits to date. Patients I see have an average of 8 diagnoses and take an average of 18 medicines per day, including over-the-counter and herbal products. Patients have an average of 4 medication-related problems. The most common problem identified relates to compliance. In other words, patients are not able to adhere to their medication regimen because they don't understand it or they can't afford it. These problems may be resolved by using generic medicines to increase affordability or educating patients to take medicines correctly. Other pharmacist interventions include making recommendations to physicians to eliminate duplicate medicines or manage drug-drug interactions. Among the recommendations made to physicians thus far, 45% have been accepted, while 52% have been addressed at patients' next appointments. I also coordinate follow-up care with physicians, nurses, patients, and caregivers to ensure that patients are educated and able to adhere to any changes in medication therapy. The results of this program have been very positive. Overall, 80% of all medication-related problems identified have been resolved. The program has also reduced overall costs by reducing unnecessary hospitalizations and emergency room visits. From patients with complete records since the start of the program, hospitalizations have decreased from 32 to 16, and unplanned care episodes such as emergency room and urgent care visits have decreased from 16 to 8. Even though this program benefits patients, reduces medication problems, and reduces costs, MVNA does not receive payment from state public programs for the services I provide to patients in their home. We provide this service as a benefit to our patients without third-party payment. To be eligible for payment, medication management services provided by a pharmacist must be delivered in a pharmacy or medical clinic. The bill before you would authorize a pilot project to pay for in-home or community-based medication management services for patients with multiple chronic conditions and multiple medications, and evaluate whether the program reduces overall costs and improves patients' health status and management of chronic diseases. I believe that based on the results of our program thus far, the total cost of care for patients could be reduced by better managing medications. I also believe this project has the potential to be expanded statewide. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Reet. And Senator Berglund, did you have additional testimony?
If there are no other questions, then I would move that Senate File 2003 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Are there any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 2003 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, did you want to keep going? We do have Erickson Ropes. If we wanted to go back in the agenda to those, or we can keep rolling. It's your preference.
Well, why don't we just finish this and then we'll...
Senate File 1344.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have an A4 amendment to delete all A3 amendments. So...
Okay, we need to adopt both the
A3. I'd like to move to combine these.
So the A4 is drafted to the A3?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Senator Berglund moves the A3 to have that in front of us, and then Senator Berglund moves the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment. And then this is not the first stop for this, so describe both the A3 and the A4 combined, I guess.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the A3 amendment just clarifies the language we had in the bill in regard to development of community-based services and restructuring of the services that are provided at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. The first part of it also does restructuring for the METO program. It restructures it by providing for more community-based services, providing for more behavioral interventionists, and by creating a county share for those residents that remain in the facility for longer than 91 days. We believe will help to get people discharged from the facility more quickly by having more work done with the counties to find people a place back in the community when their need for the services at METO is over. The A3 amendment is some technical language in regard to the provisions relating to ANOCA that will conform the bill to the fiscal note.
So the A4 is technical to the A3. Let's move that one. Senator Berglund moves the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So then the A3 amendment you just described what the A3 amendment does as well. Any questions of members on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Berglund renews her motion on the A3 amendment. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. We have the bill in shape then, and the fiscal note on Senate File 1344 is drafted to these amendments?
It's drafted to the amendments that I just offered.
Okay. Okay.
And we generate some small savings, Mr. Chairman and members, in the first biennium in the amendment. The goal of this bill is to get services that are provided at the community level or in smaller facilities in order to generate federal funding and to serve patients at a more appropriate level of service, more customized services to reduce their length of stay. And the department has indicated that there will be some small savings in the first biennium and then larger savings in the second, in the TAILS biennium.
And you have a testifier you'd like to speak in support?
Yes, I do. I'd like to have Mr. Connolly say a few words.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Connolly. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bill Connolly representing the Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network. If you recall, when Dr. Reed Sulik was here and doing an overview of the Chemical Health and Mental Health Division, one of the pertinent slides that he showed you was that on any given day at Anoka, 25% of the people had the appropriate diagnosis to need the level of care of the inpatient facility there, and that approximately 75% of them did not need that level of care. And what this bill is attempting to do is to, one, provide the appropriate level of care, which as consumer advocates we are much in favor of, as well as save the state money. But I'd like you to also consider two other things as it relates to appropriate level of care. We have had a U.S. Supreme Court case, Olmstead case, that has been litigated against the state of Georgia that set a precedent that, in fact, people that are institutionalized have a constitutional right to the least restrictive alternative when they are institutionalized, and all the people at Anoka are, in fact, committed. Besides that, our own Commitment Act, Chapter 253B, likewise requires that we provide the least restrictive alternative to commitment, and then if a person is committed, that the service level should be the least restrictive alternative. So this bill would accomplish both of those legal requirements also. Again, while saving the state money, we support the bill. Hope you'll do likewise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly. And I do see that there's any questions of members now that we've had the supporters. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund. I have gotten lots of inquiries and questions on this proposal. And I appreciate that both Senator Berglund and the fiscal note both point out and indicate that this is some reform that's going to happen over a period of time and will happen in phases. And I think that we need to be very clear that the intent here is to reorganize, regroup, and think about how we're delivering these services. The intent here is not to not deliver services.
That's absolutely correct. And, in fact, we're not going to be delivering services with anything other than state employees as well. It's just that we have one mode right now for people committed in the metropolitan area to serve them. And it's clear that we need more modalities to serve them more appropriately. And if you're trying to step someone down from a full hospitalization, it's pretty hard to do that if all you have is a hospital program. And so we expect people will be better integrated back into the community with more of an array of services. And we believe that we can also generate some revenue to help support our services. We're not ending services, and we're not closing Anoka. That's not what this bill's about.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. And we do have Mr. McAfee here to speak in opposition to the bill, is my understanding. Mr. McAfee, welcome to the committee. State your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the division. I'm Mark McAfee, representing AFSCME Council 5. This has been a work in progress, as to quote Senator Berglund. We're into about our third iteration on this. And, you know, I appreciate what the statements that were just made. I know the intent, at least is on paper, is to have state employees to continue to do these jobs. That's very important to us. I think we should know that, of course, we're in a budget deficit. We need to see savings. I think this particular plan shows savings on paper. There's an intent to develop a plan. We don't know yet exactly how the plan will operate. The fiscal note says there'll be no impact on, you know, FTEs. We certainly hope that that's true, but we learn in our business that we have to have firmer assurances than that. So I guess I'll say we appreciate the approach Senator Berglund has taken to consult with us as we go forward. We do not feel enough comfort to endorse this at this time, so we'll remain opposed. But with that, I'll just stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Any other questions of members? Senator Sharon.
Yeah, Mr. McAfee, thank you. I need to understand what the concern is. If this is being proposed as a way to provide the proper level of care based on the client's level of need for service, and that employees will be state employees, I'm unclear as to what it is that is the concern from your organization.
Mr. McAfee.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I think, first of all, in this whole plan, we could take Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. You know, statements made that at any given time, 25% of the people belong in there. In talking to, you know, DHS, I think maybe Dr. Sulik is the expert on this locus of care, these levels. But if, you know, Mr. Tesner with DHS, you know, and asked him, you know, there's locus 6, you definitely belong in Anoka. Locus 5, people vary. They may vary day to day, you know, where they fit within that. So, first of all, if we're going to operate Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, you know, is it 25% of the beds, or how many do we have that are actually committed to that inpatient care? At this point, there's a presumption of what's needed, but there isn't yet at least a clear plan on it. We're not questioning that some of the folks, you know, that community services may be appropriate and that they be developed. But for our folks, and we represent, you know, 300 plus people in Anoka. We represent a considerable number of folks in Meadow. So we need, for us, we'd like to see, you know, more of the plan fleshed out. What we have here is savings on paper. We have the intent of a plan, but we need a little bit more before we can endorse it.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and members, I understand that it might be in a different time preferable to do a plan and then come back and then, you know, decide whether to move forward and count the savings, but we're not in an ideal time. We're in a time where we need to try to figure out sensible ways to get savings out of the budget. And I think most of us do not believe that all of the things the governor has proposed are sensible ways to get savings out of the budget. And so I would say that I believe we need to move ahead with this without having an ideal situation in front of us. That doesn't mean that in the future we couldn't come back to this and review it, modify it, change it, if we think we need to. But I think at this point we need to make a firm commitment to reforming the services that are operated in these two state-operated programs so that they can better meet the needs of the patients that we serve.
Thank you. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to commend Senator Berglund for bringing this up because, members, if you remember, we haven't had that many fiscal notes that show a saving lately, and this is substantial savings. And as we know, everybody has to come to the table in this budget situation that we have. So I really appreciate the work that you've done with everybody at this. And it is truly the type of health care reform that we want to implement. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1344 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 1344, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund?
The next bill is Senate File 1401. And
on 1401.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair,
Senator,
are you skipping
Fishbach
over 1403?
No, we're going to do that. Would you like to do that next instead?
Sorry, I just wanted to make sure I was following along correctly.
Yeah.
We're taking up 1401, Senator Berglund?
Yes, why don't we do that?
Senate File 1401.
And I have an amendment. I have several amendments.
I believe we have copies of those. We'll have those distributed. This is not the first committee stop, so we'll have you describe.
So why don't we start with the A5 amendment?
Thanks. The A5 amendment. Senator Berglund.
And this amendment changes the e-prescribing language in the bill from a demonstration project to requiring it for all prescribers using e-prescribing in Minnesota, which eventually will be everybody. And it also gives the commissioner authority to review the list of ADHD drugs that require prior authorization and a second opinion in order to periodically update the list. We believe the first part of this amendment should generate a higher savings fiscal note than the department has given us.
The fiscal note we have before us, Senator Berglund, is drafted the bill without these amendments, correct?
Right.
Okay. Any questions on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Berglund renews her motion on the A5 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We have additional amendments?
Now, the A3 amendment is an amendment that would add some dental provisions that we've been working on that, unfortunately, the bill isn't in this committee. It would create an urgent care dental services pilot project. This would mean that providers around the state could agree to take patients that otherwise are showing up in emergency rooms for dental care and actually be able to provide them with dental care, kind of like an urgent care center would for health care, to avoid those higher costs and to actually get people the service that they need. The second part of the amendment is providing for dental care in nursing facilities as a pilot project. This would allow providers to provide services to all the patients in the nursing home without having to have those patients individually be scheduled in a community dental office and have to be transported perhaps several times to receive the treatment that they need. The next part of the bill is creating a dental healthcare home pilot project This would be this would take dental care out of our managed care contracts and create dental care homes instead, to see if there are savings both by trying to create more of a continuous provider for a patient and also to see if we can get savings by providing it in a different manner. And then there is provisions that would limit the dental services that would be available both to children and to adults. We've been working with the provider community quite a bit to try to hone this list down so that we mostly are simply spacing the services out over a longer period of time, not providing them quite as frequently, and believe this would not have a detrimental impact on the clients we serve, but still generate some savings in the dental program. And then the last part of this amendment would carve dental services out from PMAP. I'm offering this amendment, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so that we can get a fiscal note on it.
Okay.
We're not in a position to say that every one of these ideas is going to be something that we should move ahead with, but we really do need to get a fiscal note to find out. Most people think that the sum or all of these provisions will have savings.
Questions of members. Senator Bretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the way this is worded, I'm not clear if this is limiting it. So allowing preventive services or not allowing preventive services?
Senator Berglund, where are you at, Senator Bretner-Solon?
On line 2.5 and 2.24.
It is limiting the time period at which certain preventative services would be offered. So they would not be offered quite as frequently.
Okay.
But they would still be offered.
Other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Berglund renews her motion on the A3 amendment. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have the A4 amendment, which has some housekeeping changes to Senator Berglund's A3 amendment. We've sort of been working on this very quickly. And Senator Berglund's projects here, the dental care projects, particularly the dental care in nursing facilities, has been standard practice for one of the local dentists in the area. It's Appletree Dental specifically. And they were consulted on this bill and gave us some recommendations on best practices and things that have been working and things we need to include in this language to get it tuned up so it's the best possible program. And so the A4 amendment deals primarily with dental care and nursing facilities section of the bill, and there's just one line that's in sub 3, dental health care homes. The very last line would, after rooms, add and reductions in hospitalizations for medical problems linked with oral infections. So
Senator Erickson Ropes, there's another one in subdivision 3 there where you change a may to a shall, I notice.
Okay, let's see.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a copy of the amendment. So.
We need to get Senator Berglund a copy of the A4 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I feel like we're kind of discussing two amendments, the A3 and the A4, so my suggestion is that we deal with one amendment at a time.
A4 is an amendment to the A3 amendment.
That was so not made clear, Mr. Chair.
My apologies. The A3 amendment is before us. We were about to move it. The A4 amendment was offered as an amendment to the A3 amendment so that everyone is clear on where we are. So Senator Berglund described the A3 amendment. Erickson Ropes is trying to amend that amendment before we adopt it. Do you have questions on that, on the A4 amendment to the A3 amendments, Senator?
Mr. Lynch? Chair, I don't have any questions on the A3. I would prefer that we adopt the A3 and then move on to the next amendment. I think that's a little cleaner, but.
Well, this is
go ahead,
an
Mr.
amendment
Chair.
To the A3.
I understand.
Amendment. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I believe the author, Senator Berglund, would consider this a friendly amendment.
I think it is.
I'm sorry, what?
It is a friendly amendment.
The A4 is a friendly amendment to the A3 amendment. Any other questions on the A4 amendment? Okay, on the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment, all those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the A3 amendment in shape. Any further questions on the A3 amendment as amended? Seeing none. On the A3 amendment as amended, all those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, just in discussing the fiscal note, the costs that are showing up on this fiscal note primarily have to do with carving prescriptions out of the PMAP contracts in order for the state to purchase them and get the additional federal rebates. I think the fiscal note goes on to assume then that the state would also take on the role of managing these medications, which was not the intention of the bill. The bill, the intention was that the managed care plans would still manage the use of the medications, but we would just carve them out for the purposes of purchasing them. We still think there might be some advantage to this, especially if we can time it right. One of the reasons for the costs here is that the rebates come in later after you've purchased the drugs. And so we're working on trying to see if we can time this so that we can actually benefit from the savings. But other than that, I think the other provisions in the bill are showing savings within the fiscal note. And so it'd just be a matter of laying this aside to get the bill as amended.
We do have someone who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill, so we'll
That's fine.
We'll take opposition testimony. Jeanette Coleman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeanette Coleman, and I'm here to represent the Council of Health Plans. And we have not had a chance to sit down with Senator Berglund going forward on this, and be happy to do so. Senator Berglund just provided some clarification that wasn't clear from the bill. I'm not sure exactly how you would separate the purchasing of drugs from the management of those drugs, but we would like to explore that. One of the concerns that we have with carving out from the health plans the prescription drug portion of the benefit is the incredible importance there is to having data on prescription drugs in order to do two things. One, provide high-quality care to the individual. So individuals who are potentially at risk for adverse health selections or currently experiencing adverse health selection, we use the prescription data to identify those individuals. We do need real-time information on the prescription data, because another thing we do is if somebody is their care is being managed, we see a prescription come through that was filled, and it will have an adverse drug reaction with another drug that they're currently on. A nurse will contact that individual and the doctor immediately to be sure that they avoid that drug adverse drug situation. The other thing where the drug information is incredibly important to the health plans is as we're trying to move forward in health care reform and payment reform, and we're trying to identify efficient health care providers, one of a large driver of efficiency of providers is their use and prescribing patterns. And we actually have pulled together data that was somewhat surprising to us just recently, that as we're looking at efficiencies of some care systems, somewhat surprisingly, even more than inpatient hospital, the prescribing drug patterns of that clinic is driving whether or not they're an efficient use of resources compared to their peers. And so these are all things that we would be happy to sit down with Senator Berglund to ensure that as we move forward here, we're not taking away the ability to do those things. The one last comment I would like to suggest and have the committee consider, if you remove, you know, part of the purchasing power that the health plans have in these prescription drugs is because we're purchasing the drugs for all of our Medicare enrollees, for our Medicaid enrollees, and also for our commercial enrollees. If you pull out a large chunk of that, it actually will deplete the health plan's ability to purchase drugs, and it will create a cost shift for the commercial market. And the cost for purchasing commercial market for both large employers, small employers, this one doesn't have an ERISA issue, it would impact all, and it would impact the cost for those drugs. So with that, I would take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. Now, this was part of the original bill and was included in the fiscal note, correct?
Yes, but I think some of the assumptions are not correct.
Okay, so you need
note.
To continue to work on the fiscal note. Any other questions of Senator Berglund? Seeing none, Senator Berglund moves that Senate file 1401, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Senator Mr. Berglund. Chairman, let's go to 1403.
Senate file 1403.
And I have an amendment for this bill as well.
It does not appear to be in the packet, so we'll have that distributed. Is this the first hearing?
Yes.
So we'll just adopt the amendment, and then you can describe the bill. It'll be an author's amendment. Mm-hmm. It is the A1, author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we have the bill in shape. It is a delete everything amendment, so if you can describe it to us.
Mr. Chairman and members, we've been working on trying to do two things here, bring down the rate of cesarean section births in our public health programs and to also try to reduce costs. And originally we started out, as you can see, with a bill that was going to prior authorize cesareans, and we found out the state already does that. The only problem is that they don't deny anything because they're afraid to. I might just add that that's not what happens in all the other states. But rather than try and push water uphill, we are trying another approach here, which is a blended rate for all births that are not normal vaginal deliveries. And by creating a blended rate, we hope to encourage fewer cesarean section births. We believe right now that we could probably reduce that rate by about 5%. And, and provide a financial incentive not to have that rate keep increasing. And in doing so, however, when we create a blended rate, we are creating a little bit higher rate for surgical births that do not involve cesarean section. So we anticipate savings overall on this, but it should be clear that we're reducing one part of the rate and we're increasing another part of the rate. And my purpose in amending this bill today is to get a new fiscal note based on the amendment.
Okay. On the A1 amendment, questions of members? Actually, on the bill, we already adopted the A1 amendment. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 1403? Seeing none. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1403, as amended, be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Senator Erickson-Ropes will get you up to the table. And 11:55.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today we have 11:55, which is an adult foster care providers bill that would increase the maximum number of residents in a facility. And this is one of those bills, I think most of you heard it in Healthcare Policy Committee, but we had some local people, Denny Thede, who's here from the Home and Community Options Program in Winona, who proactively came forward with some ideas on how they could save money within the adult foster care system. They knew cuts were coming, and they came up with some ideas on efficiencies. So it has to do with the homes and the bed capacity and licensing capacity for beds. So I'll let Mr. Thede just real quickly remind you of what the bill is about, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Thede.
Thank you, Senator Ropes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Thede, Executive Director with Home and Community Options. We're a nonprofit in Winona County providing support to 240 individuals, children, and adults with disabilities. And as we were planning and preparing for the dire financial situation in our state, our stakeholders, including family members and consumers that we support and our staff, came up with the idea of the five-bed capacity for licensed foster care homes, which is currently four persons. Many of the provisions are included in Senate File 1155. And we were looking at the difficulty of what now is in the governor's budget of a 3% rate reduction. And while we did some good work to prepare with some cutbacks in our operations, we could not get to that benchmark of reductions without affecting quality of care. When we talk to people most intimate to the care and concern for individuals with disabilities that need 24-hour care support, we realize that cutting staff to single coverage at times when our premise and our philosophy was to ensure community integration and active treatment with training and habilitation, we realized that a five-person model would be more advantageous and allow us actually to enhance staffing in those programs. By reducing one program, four people moving into four other homes to make five people, we could meet that benchmark of a rate reduction that we anticipate necessary to balance the budget in our state. It's not with idealism that we bring this bill forward. We like the idea of community integration in small settings. Five people seems to be a number that still is manageable with that regard. The bill has many safeguards in terms of informed consent by not only the people moving, but also the people who are recipients of a new roommate. And it also has no fiscal note in terms of cost to the state, but it allows for the provision for providers to remain stable and maintain quality during this dire time. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? So you will see that the fiscal note reflects exactly what the witness has said. This would provide savings for adult foster homes, but the savings would not be reflected in the state budget, but would help them to deal with the cuts that they might be facing. So this bill could go out of the committee as a separate bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson wrote, are these federal waivers, approvals and waivers, are they going to be difficult to get done?
Senator Rosen, these are folks that already have Medicaid waivers.
Okay.
So it'd be just making changes to their living situation.
Any other questions? Senator, do you want to move the bill then?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move that 1155 as amended be passed to the floor. Is it
finance,
full finance?
You might want to talk to Senator Cohen about whether this bill could be pulled from committee.
To the floor. Thank you.
Just a suggestion to kind of ease the workload of that committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Erickson Ropes, you have the next bill then also.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a bill that has to do with families that have children with some hearing loss issues. And the bill requires the Commissioner of Health to contract with a nonprofit organization to provide support and education and assistance to families with children who are deaf or have a hearing loss. And it also increases the fee on the blood spot, the newborn blood spot test, to $105 to cover the cost of the program. And, Madam Chair, I do have an oral amendment that I'd like the committee to consider. The effective date is not listed in this bill. And since Minnesota Department of Health is under contract right now with this program, that we could push the effective date out to July 1st, 2010.
So, Senate Counsel, do you want
to? So, Madam Chair, I think at page 1 after line 20, if we just put the effective date, or this section is effective July 1, 2010.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Ropes moves adoption of that amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator, I have a few questions for the Department of Human Services about their fiscal note in regard to this bill, if there's someone who could come up. Are we drawing straws, or don't we know who's in charge? This has to do with blood spots, increasing the fee for the blood spots that are taken for newborns. No, you're not the right person, I don't think. I want someone from the Department of Human Services. Unless you want to fill in for them, which would be greatly appreciated.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting, maybe we could just hear a few words from Candace Lindau-Davies, who's the coordinator of LifeTrack Resources. It's the parent group that deals with the families.
Thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Candace Lindau-Davies. I'm the coordinator of Minnesota Hands and Voices at LifeTrack Resources, the only statewide parent-to-parent support network for Minnesota families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, I ask for your support for a $4 increase to the hospital blood spot fee to sustain our program. The Minnesota Department of Health has contracted with Minnesota Hands and Voices for 7 years, and in 2008 entrusted our program with the responsibility of calling families of newly diagnosed children on behalf of the Department of Health. Parent guides have had an 80% success in contacting families, which has meant a 54% increase to MDH's national goal of connecting families to parent-to-parent support. This has also meant a 39% increase in families and professionals served by Minnesota Hands and Voices in 2008 over 2007. We served 929 families and professionals in 2008 with 10 part-time staff who are the equivalent of 2.5 FTEs. Why is parent-to-parent support critical? Without it, many families do not follow through with medical and educational interventions in a timely manner that can make the difference in long-term outcomes. Minnesota Hands and Voices is a critical part of the statewide public health surveillance system. Scott Gross, a senior health economist for the Center for Disease Control, stated, "Comprehensive early hearing detection and intervention, EHDI, can save U.S. taxpayer dollars, taxpayers $4,500 per year in reduced educational expenditure for each child with permanent bilateral hearing loss who receives timely follow-up and early intervention services." We respectfully ask that Minnesota Hands and Voices be included in the blood spot fee funding to ensure consistency throughout the state and protect the safety net we have built to ensure each child with hearing loss gets appropriate and timely services and support. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions about the testimony?
Madam Chair, members, Shannon McMahon from DHS. I think your question was regarding DHS costs.
No, yes, in the past, we have had a fiscal note showing costs from the Department of Human Services when we've had this type of request, because we have to pay for the tests through our Medicaid program for all the births that we have paid for through our program. And so normally then we would have to increase the amount we pay to the providers to pay the increased fee.
Madam Chair, members, my discussion with the hospital rate setting staff today indicated that this type of increase would be captured when we do hospital rebasing. So this is something that would be included in the DRG when we do hospital rebasing.
The mythical hospital rebasing. Well, then, Senator, what that means is that until, if and when we ever do it, this would be eaten by the hospitals that are delivering children through the medical assistance program. They'd have to just absorb this cost. In the past, when we've had a fiscal note, we've tried to adjust the fee so that we could offset that increased cost and we could still move ahead with the program, but would not have a detrimental impact to hospitals that have medical assistance births. So I'm just a little bit frustrated by the answer that I've gotten from DHS, because I thought maybe we could actually fix this. But if we don't know how much we need to fix it, we can't.
Madam Chair, the fiscal note said they need a 0.75 FTE at 75.
Senator, that's the Department of Health fiscal note. Department of Human Services fiscal note has no numbers on it, and it has no, just says the version has no fiscal impact on our agency. So I guess the question is whether we want to try to make this bill so it would not have a negative impact on hospitals that have a high number of births through the medical assistance program. What is your desire?
Madam Chair, we are all trying to find those magical dollars. I don't have a mechanism to offer you at this point.
We know what the mechanism is. It's just a question of whether you want to do, you want to make that be a part of your bill.
Madam Chair, are you saying that we need to increase the spot test beyond the $4 we're recommending to cover the cost?
Yes, then we would have extra money that could be appropriated back to the hospitals that are doing a medical assistance births.
So should we offer a $6? Madam Chair, we could offer $6 increase.
Senator, I wasn't meaning that we should figure this out in terms of exactly what the fee should be today. I thought we'd have more information so we could do it today, but we don't. So do you want to make that addition to your bill? If you do, we can just set it aside and our staff can work on it. Okay. In terms of getting the number of births there are per year in the medical assistance program, and then we'll calculate it for ourselves.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just request to set the bill aside for the moment. We'll see if we can figure out some dollars.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson Ropes. And before you set your bill aside, I have some questions on the Department of Health fiscal note aspects of the bill. And so since you're going to be working on this, you might want to think about this as well. And particularly, and maybe I'm not understanding this, maybe Mr. Godfrey can give me some counsel on this, but with regard to the FTE that is being called for, part of that FTE is being attributed to this fee increase. And I think that's kind of interesting in and of itself, but then it seems that that 0.25 continues on each year thereafter, if I'm reading this right. I'm on page 3 of the fiscal note, Mr. Godfrey, under assumptions. So that was a question that I had. And I believe, I'm not sure, but I'm thinking the 0.5 FTE is being attributed to the part in your bill in subdivision 3A, lines 2.1 to 2.6. I'm not sure. So I'm just pointing that out or asking those questions if I'm trying to tighten it up for you a little bit. So those are just some questions that I had, and I don't know if the council has anything more to offer there, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe 1.25, but come on, it's right.
All right, now it's your turn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Barb Julich, Department of Health, I would agree the 0.25 should be a one-time position, and we could take that 0.25 out after the first year. Regarding the second half of FTE, that is for the language you described the on page 2 of the bill, the section subdivision 3A.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson-Rokes, just for the record, this is the first time that I have ever been at this table when we've seen an actual decrease in the fiscal note on the spot. So I just think this is kind of exciting. Unfortunately, I think we're at near the end of the agenda.
You need life. It's only going to encourage us.
Well, and my reading of the bill is that the organization they contract with is supposed to be providing the support to the families, not the department. Was that your intent, Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Actually, Madam Chair, I'm just reading the fiscal note, actually, having blown in here.
Well, we'll give you a minute to do that then, because that's what the half FTE is for. It's for augmenting what the contract would do, and based on what I've heard, I think the contractor's doing a pretty good job, so I don't know if we need to augment it. Right. Senator Frantzoli?
Not on this issue, Madam Chair.
So at any rate, as long as we're going to set this aside to work on it a little more, you could let us know about that, and perhaps we could take that into account when we're jiggling around this fee. Senator Prentner-Solon.
So, Madam Chair, I was wondering if we could just take my bill up for a minute to put the amendment on it, the A2 amendment, so we could get a decent fiscal note on it.
Oh, on your...
On the 1229, the PCA bill.
That would be fine if we're done with this bill. Senator Prentner-Solon?
Well, Madam Chair, do you want me to walk through everything that is included in this? Or I can do that very quickly, actually. And as I said, this is a... do you want me to sit down there?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. This is an amendment that combines language that was worked out between the Department of Human Services and the... and the provisions from the OLA PCA bill, you know, as you recall.
Do we actually have the amendment?
Yes, we do. It's an A2 amendment that is in front of us.
Well, maybe I'm the only one that doesn't
it's
have it.
It's very lengthy.
Oh, okay.
It's actually a delete everything amendment, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. And what this does, do you wish me to walk through that?
I don't think so. Why don't we
okay.
just put it on there and get a fiscal note, and then we can see what we're doing.
Okay, well, then I would move the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And then we'll just lay Senate File 1229 aside.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and I think with that, we finished our work. Thank you for your good attendance, and the meeting's adjourned. Have a great break, everybody.
Yeah, you too.
You too.
Easter Bunny comes to my house. Oh, yeah, Easter Bunny's a really nice Easter Bunny, too. With the Easter Bunny. Oh, to my kids.
So can we just everything?